Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody. The Upasika Day, and the of course the theme for the day is under the overall topic of devotion and ritual, and we'll focus on chanting in that. And these Upasika days are tend to be, say we at the beginning of the year we gather and collate the various requests that have been made for topics to pursue, and so chanting was one of them that we thought would be a good one to look into and look through the different aspects of the of chanting, certainly in the West there tends to be less experience with chanting, and as a practice, and as a part of the kind of daily life or the routines of the say a Buddhist practices or Buddhist ceremony ritual. Like there, of course, there's more known about meditation. There's more known about say the teachings and scriptural knowledge, and not so much about chanting. Doesn't play much of a role in people's lives in the West. But in certainly in traditional Buddhist cultures, then chanting forms a large part of, say, maybe a Buddhist's daily practice, daily life. Or I was mentioning to the Sangha yesterday, like Ajahn Mun, who's considered sort of the primo meditation master of the era, and but he wouldn't begin his meditations until he'd chanted about an hour or so, and then start meditating. So it's very much seen as a part and parcel of the training of the mind. And bringing to mind aspects of the objects of devotion, bringing to mind the Buddha, bringing to mind certain teachings, like many of the... That's one of the things with this new chanting book that we have now. There's more chants are... available, and we've been doing some of them, but a lot of the new chants that we're able to access are teachings, so that's a reflective a recollection that is being used. The chanting itself is formed a very early part of the during the Buddha's time of how the teachings were conveyed, how they were passed on, because it was not a written tradition. There wasn't a written scriptural tradition at the time of the Buddha. It wasn't that there wasn't writing at the time of the Buddha, But writing was considered kind of crass, and you know, something that you do if you're in service of the king. So it's more like business oriented. So the administration of the realm, you'd have to use writing. But anything of real importance, religion, poetry, literature, all of that was passed on orally, and so memorized and recited together. So that was certainly the origins of chanting, or the recitations of the teachings and the way that one became familiar with the teachings. There'd be a group of monks would gather and then they would recite together, and same with the nuns. The nuns would be, they'd be gathering together and they'd be reciting together, and different groups would, depending on their own interest, depending on their own facility, then they would be doing, say, fewer or more, or they'd be focusing on the teachings, or focusing on the discipline. So that would be how they would be learning the teachings. There's a sutta in the there's a couple suttas actually but one in particular that comes to mind, where the Buddha asks a monk if he's been learning the teachings and how long he's been ordained, how's he learning the teachings, and then the Buddha asks him to recite the section on the eights, which is the part of the Sutta Nipata, and some of the, you know, it's like a very ancient layer of the teachings are in that section of the Sutta Nipata, and then the Buddha is, you can imagine being asked by the Buddha to recite the teachings. I mean, that's got to be tough. Then the monk goes ahead and recites it, and the Buddha praises him for his memorization of them, the enunciation, the cadence, it was an ordinary part of the training as a monastic, and how one learned the teachings, and it's also how they were passed on, so that you'd get groups of monks who had learned the teachings, and then they would recite together, and then there'd be somebody who would be listening, who was experienced, and then when you hear an anomaly, or when they trip each other up, okay, where do we go wrong? You discuss it. You clarify what was the proper wording of that, and then get it down, memorize it, pass it on again. So that's how the from time to time there were gatherings, and say at the end of the Buddha's life, after his cremation, and the Sangha came together and they recited together the teachings. Ananda, of course, who was foremost in memory, he oversaw that, and he was asked to recite. But then everybody else is sort of there listening, because they've been reciting it as well. And Ananda's got the breadth of the knowledge, but then, you know, so many others have been doing all these different parts of it, and everybody's listening. And then 100 years after the Buddha's passing, then they come together, and of course there's a dissemination of the dispensation, and the Sangha's growing, and then there's concern of, okay, things are starting to get wonky here, come together, and both they say the discipline, rules of training would be recited, the teachings would be and then agreeing again, okay, this is the body of work that we all feel confident and comfortable of. This is the teachings as we heard them and learned them from the Buddha. So that chanting is plays a huge role in that memorization and learning. And of course, even in modern day India, say the Brahminical traditions are still ritual ceremony teachings are still passed on in that way. One of the novices, yes, is novice still at Ajahn Viradhamma's monastery in Tisarna, is from southern India, and he grew up in a Brahmin family, learning the Vedic chants and rituals, and passing on the teachings. So he has a huge body of memorized teachings from his. He did from the time he was a young boy till about the time he was 25. Then he got a computer science degree. You know? And there's another story of modern India. and then, of course, he went on to do different things and started up businesses and whatnot. And then he got fed up and came to the monastery. But when he chants, he loves learning the suttas and learning and the Buddhist scriptures. And it's incredibly easy for him. He just soaks it in and then recites it. It's a facility of them. It's a capability that we can cultivate and develop. And when you, especially if you start from a very young age, then the brain actually learns in that way. Comes to mind the Patimokkha rules. There's about 45 pages of Pali, all of the 227 rules of training. When I learned it, you just knuckle down, and you just keep doing it, and you keep bashing away at it, and it finally sort of sinks in. And it took me about 6 months to get it so that I could recite it. Jinyaniko, how long did it take you?
5 months.
5 months.
3.5 years.
Pankachana.
Oh, something like maybe 14, 15 months.
Okay, yeah. So just a range. People remember Ajahn Brecha. He came to visit here a couple years ago, Thai monk, ordained when he was quite young. Took him 2 weeks. Ajahn Chah's former secretary, who ordained when he was quite young and was close to Ajahn Chah, that took him a week. So you know, it's something because you're familiar with it, you learn it. So that in ancient India, then the learning and recitation of the teachings and the liturgy and the different uses of it were memorized and then relied upon for different purposes. Part of it was passing on knowledge, another part of it was just the actual communal nature of coming together and doing something together. You're doing your gathering together, and that tends to be how it's used today, and that it forms a part of the daily life within the monastery, so that it's something you can come together and do. Part of it is of course the learning how to memorize, but there's also the learning how to actually chant and learn how to use it as a means by which you become mindful, that you put energy into the act of chanting, and by putting energy into it, it brightens the mind, makes the mind peaceful, because one's chanting, things that are the way that chanting is done is that it's, say, our chanting it's not musical per se. There's a fairly steady rhythm and cadence to it, so it has a settling quality to the mind as we chant, and that's a very good use for that. But it's also learning how to, because chanting isn't just about just belting it out, it's learning how to, a lot of chanting is accomplished through your ear, in that you're paying attention to the people around you, nearby you, and their tone and their rhythm, and you're harmonizing and synchronizing your chanting with them. So there's a necessary basis of mindfulness that needs to be developed, and so because it's I can remember Thanksgiving retreat. There used to be a particular person who would come, and of course, a lot of people were new with the chanting, and then we were seriously outnumbered. Yes, the monks, and remember one particular person just really, high grades for enthusiasm, but tone and just flat, and it just pull everybody down. And sit right in the front. It happened every year. It's also, it's not just the actual producing of sound, but it's it's an act of mindfulness and mindfulness training of how to harmonize, that was one of the things that my mother when she first saw me as a monk. I think they arrived in the afternoon. The next day, there was a meal offering. It was in Bangkok. Meal offering was staying at a layperson's house. They had an extra house, so I was staying there. My parents were staying in the big house, and as well as Joseph Kappel's parents, Ajahn Pabakro. His parents were in Thailand at the same time. So we went off on alms round, and we had our meal, and then meal offering, and then we gave the blessing chant. And that there were two things that impressed my mom. One is that I put all my food in my bowl, things were all together and touching. I was a very fussy eater growing up. But then also that I was able to harmonize with the monk, because it used to be, it was very painful for my mother to hear me sing. sing, in air quotes. And she would always just remember her, just, "You're not listening." And it was just that simple act of, you listen and you harmonize and you pay attention to the rhythm. So that's part of chanting, is learning how to do that. So it's a developing of mindfulness in that way. As we do a recitation of the different chants, then so many of them are rooted in the recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, recollection of the Triple Gem, recollection of its central piece of the within our practice as Buddhists. And remember one time, this is one of the monks who was here in very early years of establishing Abhayagiri, Ajahn Visuddhi, and he was recounting a time when he was in Sri Lanka and living in the forest, and they were walking. Him and another elderly Sri Lankan monk were walking through the forest, and a wild elephant came out of the forest and was agitated seeing these monks, and was kind of making nervous, and you don't want to see a nervous elephant. and then the monk started chanting, and then Ajahn Visuddhi said, do see the elephant calm down really quickly? And then he asked the monk what chant he was using, and he said, well, it wasn't anything special, it was just the Itipiso chant, that which is just a recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Those we chant that pretty much every day, and it's fairly short, but he said that's really the most powerful chant in terms of protection and blessings, because one is returning to the Triple Gem as the basis, and sometimes one does that as an individual, as an example from that month or off. And sometimes you do it as a communal ritual where you'll chant the say that chant iti piso bhagavara hang sama sambuto, and it takes a couple minutes, only a couple minutes to chant it, but say you do it 108 times and then you end up, you got 2-3 hours of chanting that you're doing. And I think we've only done it once here. With everybody. We've done it with smaller groups where they get together and do it on one prat. But as a, like in a special, I think it was one New Year's where it seemed like a good idea at the time. And it was just painful. You need a really good leader and to keep the both the pace as well as the pitch up, because it's after you've been chanting for a while, it's easy to start going down, and it's not a slippery slope, it's an ever widening chasm. And but when it's done well and you've got a good leader, it's like when we were in Thailand over this winter, and we were over the New Year's, we were at Ajahn Achalo's monastery, and in the north, and there was a whole hall full of people, and Ajahn Achalo led it. He's got a very strong chanting voice and a really great pitch, and it was really uplifting and energizing, just chanting for 2.5 hours, and you get a real buzz. That's right, and especially when you're doing it with a whole hall full of people, it was really, really quite special. So those are, there's all sorts of different chants that we do, and as I say, the chanting isn't just for ourselves. I mean, say the chanting is for others. There's a sutta where a deva complains to this monk, saying a large part of his practice was chanting, and then after he had some realization, he was liberated, then he spent most of his time dwelling in kind of the bliss of liberation, and he wasn't chanting. And the devas came and complained and said, "No, when you were chanting before, we could hear the teachings, and now you're silent, and it's really not so beneficial for us." And so it's like not something that we do, say, just for our own personal benefit, but it's also that others benefit from the chanting. And when we do it, it's reciting the Buddha's teachings, reciting the qualities of Buddha Dhamma Sangha. It reverberates out. It doesn't. It's not just a solitary thing. And if one widens one's perspective of living in a universe that's populated by many realms of beings, and then there isn't a huge barrier, to me, that's you open up the possibilities of the kind of world we live in, rather than some kind of tight, narrow little material world. The one of the things that is a part of the chanting and bringing to mind as we're chanting is this: there's a certain like an asseveration of truth, in the sense of, you know, this is something that is good and true and beautiful, and may this be a benefit to others. And so that the chanting can be a conduit for that bringing that goodness into the world. And of course, bringing that into our own heart as well, because it's, you know, it's so easy to just get locked into the habit of, again, we get inured to the possibilities of goodness and peace because we see things through our own limited bias, sort of me and my little world, and to realize that we have more possibilities. It doesn't mean to go on some delusional grandiosity, but it's just sort of opening that possibility up, and one finds that both brings brightness into one's own mind, but also that possibility of bringing brightness into the lives of others. So this use of the chanting, but also so much of the chants themselves are rooted in the teaching, so that when you chant them and you become familiar with them, then much of the terminology that defines the Buddha's teachings and the path of practice are embedded in the chanting itself, in the vocabulary that we use. So then you gain a familiarity with many, many key terms that are part of the regular chants that we do. Say when we chant the morning chanting that we do pretty much every day. Because there are many terms through there that are very important for me, but there's one that just pops into my mind right now. It's like dukkho tina dukkha parita. So this bound by dukkha and obstructed by dukkha. It's in the morning chant that we do the recollection of the Buddha, the Dhamma, Sangha, and then the one after that. And that ties into a teaching in that comes up in the suttas over and over again, where the Buddha points to, bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving. And because that's one of the problems that we have of freeing the heart, is that it isn't just one thing, it's a confluence of ignorance and desire working together. And so that how do we unbind disentangle that kind of vortex of ignorance and craving that keep revolving around each other? And so and we end up bound by dukkha and obstructed by dukkha because of that. So it's a uh, And then when we start looking in terms of as a reflective tool, then we start saying, okay, how do I recognize more clearly when the mind is either getting clouded or when it's grasping at something? And so then there's a clarity that starts to come in. And having the vocabulary for it is really helpful. In the chants that we've been, especially with the new chanting books that we got, well, it's a couple of years now, but it's when you chant the Eightfold Path, and then the Eightfold Path is clearly laid out, and it, there's the okay. Well, what is right aspiration? What is right intention? Samma sankappa. And then so, there it is. Just that freedom from non-ill will, freedom from desire, freedom from the freedom from the thought of harming. And it's quite simple, but you got a clear definition that is from the scriptural basis, and it's actually not complicated. It's not, and it gives good guidelines, or the what was right mindfulness, and seeing how the Buddha, the words that the Buddha himself used to define mindfulness, and I found it so helpful, and because I've chanted it so many times, it's just there on the tip of my tongue that there's the four constituents of right mindfulness. Atapi sampajano satima vinaya boche vinaya loke bicha tomanasa. So then it's that ardent mindful, that clearly comprehending. And the pulling back from the likes and dislikes of the world, that's your definition of mindfulness from a Buddhist perspective, as opposed to all of the different, we get swamped with all these different ideas about mindfulness, and some of them are good and some of them are not, but it's helpful to have, well, what did the Buddha himself say? Same with right effort. And just when you chant it over and over again, and those, the Buddha says, oh, your effort is like this. And it's this clear definition. When you've learned it, you chant it, you've heard it, and it pops up in the mind when you're meditating or contemplating, because it's there, and it seeps into the mind, and that's the kind of thing you really want seeping into the mind, rather than so many things that we get through media, and it has a very different effect. So that the chanting is a helpful tool for both preparing the mind, training the mind, and understanding the mind. It's a practice in itself, and it's something tangible that you can put effort into. I think that's one of the reasons why, in traditional cultures, then chanting forms a large piece of within a Buddhist culture. I know certainly for, say, Thai culture, Burmese culture, Sri Lankan culture, they all start learning chanting from the time they're little, and it helps. It's something tangible that you can put effort into. You learn something, you're able to maintain it, and then it's a good anchor for when one, both on a daily basis, but then also when I can remember one time talking to a long-term disciple of Ajahn Chah, and he had left Ubon, the province where Ajahn Chah lived, when he was fairly young. He just recently got married. They might have had one of their children, but then, it's like that was at the end of after the American forces pulled out of Ubon. The economy basically collapsed in Ubon, so then he make a livelihood. So he went to Bangkok, setting up a business, putting a lot of effort into setting his family up and being in the business world in a big city. And he said it was really difficult, and it was really suffering a lot. I was really confused, but every day I would sit down and sit in front of my shrine, and at least I would chant the recollections of the refuges, the precepts, and the chants paying homage to Ajahn Chah, and sit with it. And sometimes I just do that over and over and tell Ajahn Chah my troubles. but it's something tangible and something very wholesome. Whereas you just try to sit and be mindful with bare awareness, and it's swamped with everything. So it's a really helpful tool, and having another tool in one's toolkit is really helpful. So those are some thoughts on kind of history, origin, overview. And any questions? Yeah, John.
I had a question that I asked in some other form, either here or on the coast, and I can't remember which is, in reading this, this doing this reading that was attached to this workshop, I noticed again reference to using the practice to, in almost a prayerful manner, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking specifically of something really specific. My niece, one of my nieces, has been afflicted with epilepsy, and she's managed, and now she's in her 20s, and she was all set to go to college, and it really came roaring back. Mm-hmm. So my brother sent me a picture of her, and I can't get out of my head, really. I mean, but it keeps coming back. It's kind of haunting, of her from behind with her hospital gown and her hair coming down, and then this incredible nest of color-coded wires hanging down her back, coming out of her brain. And she's in this really serious process, and she's amazing. She's very tough, and she likes horseback running. She told my brother to stop moping around. still, it's extremely scary. It probably is harder for he and his wife in a sense than for her, because she's to live with it. But it's a very kind of edgy new set of processes at this high-end hospital in New York. And so, I've been thinking how to, and of course other people in the family are talking, oh yeah, we're praying for her and everything, and they're Christians. And I know there's, and we've discussed it before, but I'd like some more clarity about how to approach that.
Is that right? I mean, that's actually a really skillful use of chanting where one is, and that's oftentimes people will ask for dedications where we, mm-hmm. and we do that where people, somebody's ill, somebody's passed away, somebody's in difficulty. from a theistic perspective, and it's kind of like praying for somebody or praying to somebody. But, I think a way of holding it, I said, like with the chanting, is what one is doing is bringing something wholesome and skillful into the world and setting up an asservation or a dedication in the mind, whereas may this be a benefit to so and so in such and such a way. So it's like a setting of an intention for goodness, certainly the first person that benefits is yourself.
Yeah,
and that's tangible, and you never know what happens. Because I think also that they've been doing some research where and trying to track the people who were prayed for or not. You know, even from a Christian background, and people who have been prayed for tend to statistically tend to have better results, more positive results. So there's no way of making that. Why or how, but that's what they're finding. And it could be completely random, but statistically something's going on.
So it's sort of a matter of dedicating any merit you accrue or your practice to Sarah, for example, or to my niece, for example, like having that, carrying that thought as well.
Yeah. I mean, to letting her know that, that's what you're doing, what you say you've asked the monastery to dedicate chants for her well-being. And, just knowing that somebody is, caring for her, that's a big deal.
I guess I brought this up when we were talking about the fire kind of turning around here at the monastery.
Right.
Going back uphill, and the fire chief saying that was, he had no rational explanation for that. And
right.
And he talked about all the prayers that were happening all over the world for the monastery. And so I said, well, what is that? Yeah.
And it's sort of like, who knows? We create our own reality sometimes. But but sometimes, the world kind of... again, that's where I think you don't have to know exactly, but it's a better world to live in.
Yeah.
When you put something good into it, and something good happens.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, there's a related question online.
Yes.
Somebody asked, how can you use chanting to work with long-term physical pain, and also, as John was asking about, other people's healing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the working with physical pain is mental pain, where again you have something tangible where you're putting energy into it. It has the effect of settling the mind and giving the mind something tangible to focus on, so that it can relax and release the kind of tension around pain and the fear that comes up around pain, because that's one of the things that constant or chronic pain. There's an element of fear and frustration of it being, but where if you've got something skillful to put one's attention onto and energy to put into, then one the mind can absorb into that, as opposed to absorbing into the fear and frustration of dealing with pain.
Yeah. Is there any Are there any of the chants that wouldn't be appropriate for a layperson to chant?
Every single one. They're all fair game, and we'll be part of the session today. We'll be introducing some of the chants and giving some instruction on how to work with it, how to use it. Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions for how to chant so that you generate energy? Because I know that when I do longer chanting or group and chanting, that I get tired after a while, and sort of kind of my voice doesn't have as much strength. Or do you have any suggestions for that?
Posture, breathing. You know, it's a different, like it's really, really paying attention to posture, opening the chest, chanting from down here. Often people chant from here. And then they, iti piso bhagavana. But it is that posture, you don't have to be Rama. It's the same with sitting, really. It's like getting a balanced posture, putting energy into letting the breath come right into the body, paying attention to the resonance of the chant, and then letting the chant sort of carry one. Because oftentimes we're trying too hard to make it happen, mm-hmm. It does get tiring. But there's a nice balance that we can hold when we're chanting, when we've got a good posture, the rhythm of the breathing is not too slow, not too forced, but it's deep, and there's a kind of a rejuvenation with a deeper breath and chanting. So those aspects are quite important.
Is there any danger to chanting? I know some traditions kind of say that, like, when you chant, you should be careful because you can generate bad karma.
Wow. Yeah. Yes, maybe you're off. Yeah, off key. Throwing the whole room off. But no, I don't.
A small question. I noticed the translation of the in the precepts, like it used to be false and harmful speech.
Yes.
And it's just lying.
Is yes.
Reason behind.
Reason behind it. I don't actually know the reason. I know. I mean, it was translated by committee. the actual word. Musawada is a false speech. So, whereas, so it's being more faithful to the word itself, whereas a false and harmful speech was actually more in line with the four courses of wholesome speech, as opposed to the actual precept on that third precept of false speech. So there's like in the Eightfold Path, there's ten courses of wholesome action. Four of them are around speech, and it's a very important foundation actions of body, speech, and mind. And so that gives a good flavor of that, so false and harmful speech, whereas the actual precept is very precise in terms of, okay, false speech, lying. So it's translated pedantically, in my view. Whereas I think usefully, I think it was more useful to have that false and harmful speech. But it isn't quite, isn't absolutely precise. Yeah?
Is there something I can use to help me with the pacing of the chants? Because sometimes it seems like it speed up a little bit and slow down. And I'm not familiar at all with...
this monk?
Cute.
Yeah, that's sort of the cue for coming in. This is Ajahn Karuna Dhamma's next section. It's going to be around the pronunciation and the nuts and bolts of. he's not a shill in the audience. Yeah. But that's the next part of the session. Hmm. We ready to go into that section?